This is Sport in the Fields, in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. Hope you're enjoying the series so far. I'm Jonathan Overend, in the company of some of the UK's most familiar sporting voices and also some Olympic greats along the way. And what I wanted to do for this episode is get two broadcasters together who know each other very, very well to talk about one of those Olympic legends. There's no doubt that when you list the top 10, if you like, or even a top two, Usain Bolt is right up there. And one of our team knows him particularly well because she's been interviewing him for years and years and years. When we built this team, I thought, right, we need a bit of Sonia McLaughlin on this because she's brilliant. And we also need a bit of Marcus Buckland on this because he's brilliant. But what you don't know is when you put them together, sparks tend to fly. And I'm just going to, like, sit back now, guys. This is your episode.
No, Jonathan, please stay between us. Even if we're remotely broadcasting this, I remain apprehensive if you don't. How are you, Sonj?
I'm all right, Marcus. It's lovely to talk to you. We tend to sort of border on the inappropriate when we're on air. We work together on live at Wimbledon Radio.
Yeah.
And we just get the giggles, don't we, Marcus?
We do. I mean, if we just set the context of this, we actually first met, and this, I'm afraid, does demonstrate that we've been around for a little while now, but we both joined the BBC in the summer of 1988. Sonja was on the summer graduate scheme, and I then followed in the October. And I remember going in, we were given a little taster in that summer, and I saw this tall, commanding, elegant young lady who was clearly in control of her young group then. And we just struck up a little bit of a bond that fortunately has continued to this day.
It has. You know that annoying kid brother that you never had, that you kind of secretly wish you did have? I think I found it in Marcus Buckland 32 yeah. years ago.
I suppose I'll take that as a compliment, and you are most certainly another bossy older sister. I've already got a few of those, so you can be added to the paddock.
You're a bit of a tease, though, Marcus, aren't you?
In what way, Jonathan?
Well, I don't know. You've just got this sort of playful side to you, and you hear it in your broadcasting, you know, even when you're doing serve and volley statistics or something like that. You know.
Well,
it's nice. I enjoy it.
The thing is, one of the things I remember being taught right from the word go, actually two things, and Sonja might remember that certainly the BBC Broadcasting Centre, you were told never to say anything in front of a microphone that you'll ever regret. And on one occasion, we were all in the studio, and there was a big sort of classroom next door where the guy in charge, and I can't for the life of me remember what his name was now, but he was in there, and we were all basically being incredibly rude about this guy and not realising, of course, that the microphone was being broadcast straight into the room next door. And that was a lesson that we learned pretty quickly. But also someone said to me, you must imagine that you are talking to somebody possibly who is blind, and they just want you to be their friend, to guide them through whatever you are seeing, and to try and make it as humorous as possible where appropriate, as dramatic as possible where appropriate, but just be yourself. I think that's the most important thing, and I like a bit of a laugh and a joke in everyday life, and I don't see why that should be any different when you're broadcasting, as long, of course, as you are appropriate to whatever you're actually describing.
There are those times where you just have to engage your brain. You have to really stop yourself from saying the thing you actually want to say, but you know it's not appropriate. So you just go, no, you can't say that, Sonja. Don't say that. Don't say that. Don't say that. Do you remember at Wimbledon last year, Marcus? And, you know, Wimbledon is so beautiful. I'm giggling already just because Marcus is here. Wimbledon is so beautiful with all of the flora and the fauna that they have. It's a stunning place. But, you know, you're doing hours and hours and hours of broadcasting, and you've got to keep it fresh and original and lively and fun. But you just think, oh, you just go a little bit mad. And so we were on the broadcast roof, and up there is a topiary, for want of a better description. and it's this incredible piece of topiary. Then it's basically a cameraman created out of this. And I then just said, bush.
Which is not funny at all, of course.
No, it's not funny, really. But it's not funny. But because you've been on air for hours and hours and you're a little bit tired, and don't forget there's 13 days of this, you just go a little bit giddy. And Marcus and I just fell about. And yes, it was almost like I had this vision of the producer sitting in the bunker going, God, those two, really? Who decided to put these two together?
It's not a good idea. Funnily enough, that bush, I use the word without snickering in any way, is so real.
It's iconic, isn't it?
Years ago, it was the first time I'd gone home via the broadcast
room. Oh, weren't you in the dark?
And it was dark, it was pitch black,
yes,
and I went upstairs and I saw what I thought was a cameraman, and I thought, oh, they're doing the highlights show now live. I've got to be very, very careful. And I stood for about 2 minutes before I realised that it was a bush.
Oh, dear.
Might have got a good conversation out of him, you never know.
Quite possibly.
So a lot of your time is spent together at Wimbledon. I suppose if we go back to your first Olympics, you were both on the team in Atlanta, weren't you? 96?
We were. Not only were we on the same team, we shared a flight together. There were others, clearly, on the BBC team who were also on the same aeroplane. But I remember vividly getting off the flight in Atlanta and thinking, well, this is all just going to, you know, go swimming. And there was this enormous queue for accreditation, which is the pass that you wear around your neck for a fortnight. And on pain of death, do you lose this particular pass? And we were like children on Christmas Eve, because this was my first Olympics, same for Marcus. And then we just ended up in this enormous queue for accreditation. And I'll always remember, I had given a photograph in advance for my accreditation. So I thought, well, I'll pick a really nice picture of me, because you're going to have this pass around your neck for a fortnight.
You had to dig around to find one of those, didn't you?
You're funny. I was thinking, we're standing in this queue. OK, there's a lot of people here, I get that, but why is it taking so long? They've just got to pick your pass out of an envelope and hand it to you. Little did I realise that it was a queue to have your photograph taken. We've been on this really long-haul flight. And during the course of that flight, my skin had erupted and I had this enormous pimple on the end of my nose, which I think Marcus was slightly taking the mickey out of. And then, of course, horror of horrors, I then had to have a photograph taken with this large impediment, thinking, but hang on a minute, I provided a photograph. Why do I now have to have another one taken? And then I'm going to have to wear it like punishment around my neck for a fortnight. I was so mortified.
It was a beacon.
Do you remember that cue, Marcus?
Yes, I remember that. And I do remember the beacon of light on the end of your nose. And actually, it was an Olympics where two people have problems with their nose. You had the pimple incident.
Sean Curley,
who was one of our great co-commentators, fantastic hockey player, of course. When we first saw him, it looked as though he'd just been punched five times by Muhammad Ali. And Sean, for some reason, had dived into a swimming pool the day before, not realising which the shallow end was. And he was lucky that he only mashed up his nose. It was horrendous for the whole 2 weeks. So you were in good company in that regard.
I was. Sean Curley is a little bit, you know, Olympic gold medalist in 88 and so on. He is a little bit like Tigger on speed. You know, he bounces around all over the place. He's a vibrant personality. And he did. He just arrived at this very... I mean, the fact that we had a swimming pool, can I just allay any fears that people thought the BBC was spending too much money? Because it was a very small motel. And when I say swimming pool, it was more like a small pond. It was very small, but he was just straight off the plane and he saw this body of water and he just went diving in, as Marcus says, didn't pay any attention to which was the shallow end or the deep end. And he scraped it all the way down the floor of the bottom of the swimming pool and came up. And then he spent the course of the fortnight with a scab of kind of different degrees. And he looked quite sorry for himself.
And that swimming pool I have fond memories of, because Anita Lonsborough, no less, attempted to teach me to do a tumble turn. And after about an hour, she said, Marcus, let's just forget this. But this was exciting. Wherever you went, there were sporting legends even trying to coach you until they realised you were a lost cause. And on the first night, very sadly, of course, the pipe bomb went off in the Centennial Olympic Park, which very sadly killed one person and I think injured more than 100. And so this was our first night. We'd had a few drinks, just about to go to bed. Phone call from the producer, there's been a bomb. So this was more than just a sporting event.
What were the games like from that moment after the bomb? Were you in fear everywhere you travelled after that, or what?
I don't remember being in fear. It was just a horrible reminder of what can happen, what's happened before, of course. So you had to be careful. But, you know, when you're a bit younger as well, maybe a bit naive and just wanting to have fun, and you've got people like Sonia, and there are a few others whose names I will not mention.
Ron Jones?
Ron. Oh, yes, Ron. Cliff Morgan, who was still going strong in those days. John Inverdell. It was a list of who's who. Along with all the co-commentators as well. And one producer whose name I will not mention because he's still at the BBC. His initials are MA. I was there primarily to cover the tennis. The final, big occasion, it was Andre Agassi against Sergei Bruguera, and Agassi won very comfortably. But, you know, this is not what you expect your producer to ask or say to you, but he said midway through the first set, I bet you can't mention the name Ergül Niyazoglu. I'm trying to focus here on an Olympic final. Why? Who is Ergül Niyazoglu, and why do you want me to suddenly mention his name? He said, oh, he's a mate of mine, and I said I'd get you to mention his name during the final. Ergül Niyazoglu. So anyway, this is a memorable name. And I do remember second set, midway through it, I think Bruguera was injured. Physio had to come out. And I said, with absolute confidence in my voice, and Sergei Bruguera is now going to be treated by the well-known physician Ergül Niyazoglu.
You didn't.
Which was very, very unprofessional, and I still think I could be sanctioned after 24 years. But there you are, Ergül Niyazoglu got mentioned in the Olympic final, and it was all Matthew Allen's fault.
Oh, it's too funny.
Well, we want to talk to Sonia, don't we, Marcus, about her time in the company of one of the great Olympic legends, Mr. Usain Bolt. Because, Sonia, you have been the trackside athletics interviewer for, well, since when?
Athens, actually, in 2004. And it's funny because the aforementioned Matthew Allen was the athletics producer at the time. And the sport was developing in terms of how we did the coverage on Five Live. And he decided, Matthew actually used to do the post-race interviews himself as the producer. And he thought, well,
Did he? <laughs> He did.
And it actually, he thought, well, hang
on a
minute.
Did any of them ever get on air?
Standards were much lower in those days.
I think they actually did. And I think he decided, actually, I need to be worrying about what the coverage sounds like. So maybe we should get somebody who knows what they're doing to be the trackside interviewer. And he asked me to do it.
Why did they go for you then?
Oh, stop it. He asked me to do it, and it started in Athens in 2004. So that was sort of Kelly Holmes' double gold. It was the sprint relay quartet winning their incredible gold medal. So, it started in Athens in 2004, but of course it wasn't until 2008 that a certain Usain Bolt became the force and the phenomenon that we know him to be today.
So when did you meet him for the first time? Can you remember when that was?
It was literally during the rounds of the men's 100 metres in Beijing. And what a fantastic setting we have, because, you know, you talk about iconic moments in sport. Beijing gave us probably one of the most iconic stadiums at an Olympic Games in terms of the bird's nest, particularly at night. It was just so stunning in the evening. And yeah, it was during the rounds that this figure emerged. And of course, just, you know, this personality, we'd never seen anything like it in track and field. You know, track and field, given the margins of victory, hundredths of a second between success and failure, people were always very tense and very narrow-minded focus when they stood on a start line. But suddenly we had this incredible force of personality in Usain Bolt that just got everybody's attention. And then, of course, when he then went on to win the gold medal over 100 metres and won it in the style in which he did, you know, streaking away from the rest of the field, everybody was suddenly captivated. Little did we know, actually, then what we were witnessing, the force that he would go on to become. And yeah, it started this quite playful relationship that we developed.
Well, I suppose before we hear some of your experiences, we better tell everybody sort of what happens after a race. You're standing there with your microphone, but you're definitely not alone, right?
No.
So what is the process?
Well, the process, it's, as you well know, it's there's an area just beyond the finish line that's called the mix zone, and that's where the athletes and the broadcasters mix together, and you can get interviews and with anybody that you want to talk to. Now, of course, given the size of track and field, you know, these mix zones, the interview area, sometimes they were on, most of the time at Olympic Games, they were on sort of 3-4 levels. I mean, I remember in London 2012, even though we were BBC Radio and we were, if you like, the home radio station, I was positioned 40-something. So that tells you that someone like Usain Bolt, when he wins a gold medal, has potentially done 39-odd interviews before he ever gets to you. And, of course, these athletes, they all have to walk through this interview area to get back to the warm-up area and the dressing rooms. But they don't have to talk to you. That's the dynamic that is going on here. And it actually can be quite stressful when you get an athlete of Bolt's calibre, because suddenly Bolt emerges onto the scene and he becomes the talk of the town. And so suddenly the editors and producers back in the studio are going, well, you are going to get Usain Bolt, aren't you? And I kind of go, well, I don't know. What, you've got to get Usain Bolt? And I'm like, well, I don't know. He doesn't have to talk to me. And so with this sort of, I started to sort of have to think, well, hang on a minute. What am I going to do here to get Bolt to try and win and secure the all-important interview? And so, yeah, early on, it meant that I actually sort of had to get my elbows out. And I remember a sort of in Beijing famous moment where I thought, I've got to get Usain Bolt. And at that point, we hadn't built this sort of relationship that we went on to develop. So you were in this sort of little sheep pen, I would call it, at the side of the track. The space you had to operate in was very, very small. It was basically me and a microphone. And I just thought, how am I going to get Bolt to see me and to acknowledge me? So I committed the cardinal sin, which was I climbed out of my pen and I stood on the steps that went from the level that we were operating on and back under into the bowels of the stadium. So I stood on these steps, which meant as he came along, he literally couldn't get past me. He kind of had to talk to me. And of course, afterwards, there is what I would always call the Mixo Mafia. And they were actually just doing their jobs and they did it very, very well. But there was a chap called Ernest Obeng that if he glared at you, you got very, very nervous. So, of course, I got into all sorts of trouble for doing that. And they sort of threatened to remove my accreditation and shooed me back into my little pen. But I think it was that moment that Bolt went, oh, hello, who's this?
Mm. And he story does not surprise me. This story does not surprise me. So, I mean, I've got visions at London 2012. If you were number 41 in the queue, that suddenly 40 broadcasters are just seen shunted out of the way as this determined BBC reporter emerges at the front. But tell me one thing. You know, when you meet somebody as special as obviously Usain Bolt is, did you get nervous when you first started to interview him? What was he like when you looked into his eyes, and how did the relationship develop after that?
I was nervous the first time I interviewed him, and I was actually pretty nervous the last time I interviewed him. He had this aura that when he was standing in front of you, I would have to sort of take deep breaths and say, like, you can do this. Remember, you're quite good at what you do. Don't let this aura and the moment sort of psych you out in any way. And don't forget, every time Usain Bolt stood in front of me, it meant that all these people, that this crowd had they would always stay behind. And then, so you've got this enormous gallery of people watching you intently as to what you were doing. And then, of course, I had other broadcasters around me. They were watching what we were doing because people started to realise that Bolt would always stop and talk to me. And so I think, you know what it was, Marcus? I think he just got my personality. He got Five Live in terms of what we do. And he would often wander over and the first thing he'd ask me was, you know, what was the Manchester United score? he would like that we were just playful and would talk about football sometimes. But he also knew that he was going to get informed and intelligent questions. And a lot of the time when he went through that interview area post-race, and particularly when he'd won a gold medal, which was a lot of the TV and radio crews, they almost just expected him to be a performing seal, to be the same personality in the mix zone that he was on the start line. And they'd want him to do the lightning bolt pose for them on camera. And so he knew that when he got to me, he wasn't going to get any of that. He was going to be treated with respect and to be treated seriously. And we could just have an ordinary, straightforward conversation about his athleticism and what he'd just achieved, and tap in a little bit, of course, to his personality as well. And I just think that there was a level of mutual respect there.
Mm. Well, it's such a privilege. I mean, we talk about being at an Olympic Games and being able to share in those moments. And I remember going back to 1980 as a relative youngster watching Alan Wells win the 100 metres gold, and just thinking there and then it would be so incredible to be part of an experience like that. And then Daley Thompson and his wonderful rivalry with Jürgen Hinkson. I think I learned, actually, ever since that, I've always backed the underdog. I always felt a bit sorry for Jürgen Hinkson, but that was just the most wonderful battle between the two of them. And then there was Tessa Sanderson, and more recently, Jessica Ennis, people like that. So to watch them is amazing. And the privilege that we have in the broadcasting world to sometimes be one of the first, or maybe the 41st person to speak to that athlete. It's I think it's when you realise then that you've made the right career choice, haven't you?
Yeah, you know what? I'm not someone who is big into sports memorabilia. I mean, a lot of people collect it voraciously. I don't. But I do have one piece of sports memorabilia in my house. It's in my kitchen, actually, on a shelf. And it is a picture of Usain Bolt and I trackside. He's got a gold medal around his neck. I'm interviewing him. It's because part of my career is so tied up in the Usain Bolt story. I mean, he went 20 gold medals across world and Olympic Games, set world records. And I was privileged to witness all 20 and to interview him after every major title. And so he's become so indelibly part of my story, my career. And I genuinely believe that he is the greatest Olympian of all time. And you've just rattled off lots of names, Marcus, all of whom achieved incredible things. But in terms of what Usain Bolt did, his longevity, his phenomenal success, the fact he was unbeatable, the stunning impact he had on track and field, and the impact he had globally in terms of people just falling in love with him, his personality. He took sport to a whole new audience. For me, he's the greatest Olympian of all time, and to have witnessed that is an incredible privilege.
So, you may not know this, Marcus, but in 2013, and I've no idea why this happened, you'll tell me, Sonia. In 2013, just shortly after I'd described Andy Murray winning Wimbledon, they rang me up because obviously I'd stopped doing the tennis on that day, so I was in the market for new stuff. They rang me up and said, can you do Sonia's job at the anniversary games? So first of all, where were you? Why weren't you there? Were you on holiday or something?
I can't remember.
It must have been important, though, to not do that.
I genuinely can't remember.
But anyway, they said, can you do Sonia's job? Can you go to the end?
She was facing disciplinary charges for various misdemeanors while queuing up to interview Usain Bolt, I think.
Ernest Obeg had, yeah.
So there I was in your little sheep pen, as you say, and I can relate to your first experience of him in 2008 because I started getting very, very nervous. Oh, my goodness. You know, the main reason I'm standing right here is to interview Usain Bolt. And along he comes and down the line, as you say, one after the other. And obviously at the anniversary games, not quite the same interest as at the Olympic Games. So we were probably positioned four or five. But when he's doing that interview before you, Sonia.
Oh, your heart rate is
your
just
Your heart
going.
Rate goes through the roof because you know that you've got to make that first question quite good. You know you've got to look him in the eye and make some sort of impact. You can't just be standing there waving your microphone, hoping that he is going to deliver, although he probably would in that situation
and,
as well.
And of course, the other thing,
it gets you that feeling.
It does.
Also.
The other thing, of course, is that the studio are talking to you in your ear because they want to come to it live, but they don't know exactly when it's going to happen. So you're trying to frame that killer first question and the following questions in your mind, but you've also got you're counting down for the studio, so you can say, right, he's two interviews away. Well, how long's that going to take? I'm not sure, actually. Oh no, he's doing something else. Oh right, no, now he's the penultimate, he's one interview away. Yeah. But then of course you would say down the line to the studio, come to me now.
Come to me now. Yeah.
Come to me now. So he used to cotton onto this. So as he walked towards me, he would start saying, come to me now, come to me now. And there's this wonderful Jamaican accent. And of course, the fader would be up in the studio. And so the first thing you often heard on the interview was Usain Bolt taking the mickey out of me by going, oh, come to me now, come
brilliant.
To me now.
Unlucky him even more.
So anyway, along comes Usain, and after the pleasantries and hello, and just before the studio handover live, as Sonia's describing there, he says one thing to me, and that thing is, where's the pretty lady? And of course, I'm in ultra professional mode by this point. I'm about to interview the great Usain Bolt, the multiple Olympic champion, for the very first time. And this completely throws me. Because I have no idea where you are, Sonia. So I can't tell the truth. And B, I mean, how would you respond to that, Marcus? You'd have a line for him, you see.
I'm not sure that I would in that instance, to be honest. You're not taught to prepare for that sort of thing. But what did you say to him?
Otherwise engaged.
Otherwise engaged, Usain. I'm sure you'll see her next time. Anyway, here we go. Live, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Usain, tremendous, marvellous. Thank you very much for joining us
cool
and all that sort of stuff. But it just goes to show, Sonia, doesn't it, that you did develop a real rapport with him to the point where he could even go out there, prepare for a race, win a race, do a few interviews, and still sort of notice your absence.
I think it probably helped. He had a massive personality. I think it probably helped a little bit that I'm a woman. I'm not going to lie. I think he responded to that. It was playful, but it was also respectful. And if I had to ask him a question about, the latest drug scandal in athletics, he would take that and he would give an intelligent and articulate answer. And because he would always stop and say and chat to me, I thought, I was one particular meeting, I just said afterwards, look, thank you so much for everything you do for Five Live. It's really appreciated. We enjoy having you on the radio. And at which point he just looked at me and he stopped and went, you know I got you. I can't do a Jamaican accent, I'm not even going to try. But he said, you know I got you. Mm-hmm. At which point, the stadium was empty. Everybody had gone home because we'd waited for ages to get Usain Bolt. All you could hear in the stadium was the commentary team, our commentary team, that had fallen about with laughter. And you could just hear Mark Pugach say, Sonia has now gone the colour of her trousers, which are coral.
Brilliant.
I was so embarrassed. I got you.
Yeah, fantastic. And look, just as maybe a way of wrapping this up, you said one thing there which really resonated with me. Usain got it. And that was the thing I noticed from my brief experience of interviewing him and observing the way he would go about his business away from the glare, away from the track. And I couldn't believe it, how much he was running the show. He was telling the media people where he was going next. I remember he even sort of told some other steward, that there was a kid who might have dropped a flag or an autograph book over the railings. He instructed the steward to go and get it. And that was while he was doing another interview. Usain runs the show behind the scenes. There's no doubt about that, Sonia, is it? He's an absolute superstar in more ways than one.
The thing about him, think about what he did, the treble, to win the 100, the 200 and the sprint relay at three games in a row. He obviously broke world records in Beijing the first time round. He then did it again in Berlin at the World Championships. He had this incredible talent, but he also had this wonderful presence of mind. And you're right, he would always know what was going on around him. He always had the presence of mind to thank people, to, you know, do you remember always on the start line, he would have these wonderfully playful moments with the boys and the girls, the youngsters who would carry his kit and who would, he would play with them, he would chat with them. And you just then saw the enormous smile on their faces when they realised that he was talking specifically to them. He had a moment, even in that, the heat, that cauldron of intensity, the moment he was about to do a run in an Olympic final, he still had the presence of mind to live in the moment and to... Now, it helped that he was as brilliant as he was, clearly, but he was also... He was just a fantastic gift to track and field, and the sport really, really misses his presence. It really does.
Well, there are so few, Jonathan and Sonia, aren't there? So few athletes who can do all of that. I think we've all been lucky enough to interview Roger Federer, who to a similar degree, I think, has ruled the tennis world, not just in what he's done on the court, but the way he conducts himself off it and is so aware and so skilled at giving interviews in whatever it is, seven different languages. I was lucky, actually, at the 2012 Olympics, I was working for the host broadcaster. I didn't interview Lin Dan because that wasn't part of my role, but I watched the way as he went on to defend his gold medal. I think he was the first man to do that in badminton. And they'd made comparisons to Federer. They're saying Lin Dan is badminton's equivalent. And he was so charming and, you know, the crowd was just eating out of his hand. And I've got to say, Lee Chong Wei, who he played in the final, also had that presence. And having not interviewed them, I can't tell you if they had quite the same aura when you finally spoke to them. But there, you could sense there was something special about those guys, and you don't see it too often. And clearly, in Usain Bolt's songs, you've possibly got the greatest of them all.
Brilliant.
Can I tell you, he follows me on Twitter, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He's got 4.9 million followers on Twitter, so that's rather a lot. And he only follows 93 people. One of which is me. Apparently, currently I'm sandwiched between Sergio Aguero and Kevin Hart, the American actor, comedian.
Has he tweeted out the podcast?
Get him to subscribe.
We
quickly.
Need to get him to do that, don't
Come
we?
Come on, that needs to be our mission for the rest of the series.
That would be really cool. But he still follows me, and I keep thinking, he must be really bored of rugby and dogs by now.
Okay, Usain, you know the drill. If you're subscribing, if you're streaming, if you're downloading, tweet it out. You'll make Sonia and the rest of us very happy indeed. Thank you very much. And let's hope that athletics gets another Bolt one day. That ability to transcend the sport and take it to an outer sporting stratosphere is invaluable, isn't it? But there is another way of looking at it. Let's hope now track and field can make stars of the hundreds, thousands of other athletes doing exceptional things week in, week out. I mean, if you look at people like Dina Asher-Smith, Katarina Johnson-Thompson here in the UK, they certainly have the ability to command column inches and airtime. And now is the opportunity. No one can replace Usain Bolt. Let's not kid ourselves with that. But there is an opportunity now to make global stars of these other athletes, and let's hope that that opportunity is not missed. Right, Marcus, Sonia, thank you very much indeed for being with us on this fun episode. We'll see you again for the wrap party, which is going to be episode 16.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Excellent. Nice thank to you, talk Sonj. To both.
And in the meantime, subscribe if you haven't already, and we'll see you next time on Sport and the Fields in association with Aldi UK, the official supermarket partner of Team GB.